From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook.
I'm scary. Do not come near me. I am good. I want to be your best friend, but I will scare you if you step out of line.
That was Christina Tosi, the chef and owner behind the Milk Bar Dessert Empire. You've probably seen her signature baked goods. Her crack pie is all over Instagram. Her birthday cake recipe is a favorite of Hollywood celebrities. And she's not just a baker and a business maven. She's also made her way into the television industry. She's a judge on MasterChef, and she's been featured on the Netflix documentary food series Chef's Table. She has, in other words, a lot on her plate. We talked with Tosi a couple months ago in Austin, Texas. We recorded this live interview with her at our Women Rule podcast taping at South by Southwest. But we thought we'd save the episode for our podcast listeners just as Tosi's business expands further in Washington, D.C. Milk Bar is opening a new flagship location in the heart of the district, one that's meant to expand on the bakery's brick-and-mortar shops with a new menu and dessert classes. We asked Tosi about how she got her start in the restaurant industry and what she's got cooking up next. Stay tuned for our interview with Christina Tosi. On the podcast, we'll be bringing you real talk with women bosses, asking how did you make it and what advice would you give a woman looking to lead? If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at @APalmerDC. Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. And now, our interview with Christina Tosi.
So for any of you who have not been to Milk Bar, it's the sweets there are out of this world. They've got an array of fun, nostalgia-infused desserts. Some of their top sellers include cereal milk ice cream, crack pie, compost cookies, and all that goes to say, Christina, you have revolutionized what it means to eat dessert. So let's get started.
Yes.
Thank you so much. That was a very long intro.
I know.
You're the queen of desserts, and we're excited to have you here. I want to backtrack a little bit about your career. You weren't always going to be in the food industry. In college, Mm-mm. You were at the University of Virginia. You were pursuing a degree in electrical engineering. I honestly can't think of something that is more different, potentially, than the food industry. So talk to us about like that decision of, I think a lot of women, when we talked for the Women Rule podcast, struggle with that. Like, I was going down this path, and then I decided to like take that 90-degree turn.
Yeah, you know, I am very fortunate. I was raised by a great, strong, supportive family where every generation was always had the future generation in mind, right? Like, both of my parents were first-generation college goers, and that was a huge accomplishment for my grandparents. They went to school. They were professionals. They were super passionate about their 9-to-5 jobs. My mom, most passionate accountant you could ever meet. I'm like the accountant that like bakes you cookies and hugs you, and it's like, girl, you do not need a manicure today. That is not actually what your balance sheet tells you. But like, go out and do something else that makes you feel incredible and empowered. She is like that. She brought that passion to accounting, and my dad was an agricultural economist who, hilariously enough, was in charge of protecting small dairy farmers and setting dairy prices. Could not be a guy more passionate about love of the land that his life work was protecting small farmers and their craft. But so I was put on this path to get a great education and find a profession that put me even further than they were on their own professional trajectory. I'm also very competitive. And so I was like, great, I'm going to get straight A's all through school. I'm going to be an overachiever. I was put on that path, and I knew how to own it. And so I was like, I'm going to go to the most competitive in-state school, and I'm going to enroll myself in the most competitive program, which was electrical engineering. Because my mother's an accountant, I have a crazy love of math. Like an unreason, I have like literally math puzzles in my bag that I do when I'm bored. I'm not joking.
Kind of fits with baking. It's very exact.
It does. And I think what I realized in my pursuit of this education at the university level was that I was raised with so much value that was so firm and so exacting. And that really did speak to me. When you are taught to be a straight A student and to be an upstanding member of your community and to follow all the rules, the one thing as a parent that you're not actually doing typically is to teach your kids to learn the rules and then to learn how to respectfully challenge the rules. And it was when I was in college that I realized that I knew so much about who I was as a person. But there was a moment where I woke up and I realized that what I had not yet learned, but learned that day, was that my passion was not going to be found in a 9-to-5 job, and it wasn't going to be found in being an electrical engineer. And so I kind of just ripped off the Band-Aid and asked myself the question, you know, well, what is it then? Like, what is it that you can and want to do? And how are you going to be as passionate as your mom and as passionate as your dad? And what is that thing going to be where you're going to impact change in people's lives? And my answer was bake cookies. It was that simple. I was not ever taught to like have a filter in like what you say could sound silly or could sound smaller than you are or lesser than you are. And it was baked cookies, and it made perfect sense to me. And so I took that as my roadmap and I ran with it. My parents were super freaked out because you don't work that hard to set your kids up for success. And then to hear your kid say, I'm going to move to New York City and I'm going to like spend every single penny that I make at like below minimum wage for rent. And I'm going to go work in basements in like grungy basements in clothes that are only made to fit men 4 times my size. Like I'm swimming in my chef pants. I have plastic wrap that I have stretched out to make a belt to hold my pants up. Like I'm drowning in these clothes. And yet for me, deep in my heart, I had never been happier. But for them, it was a very daunting, potentially heartbreaking thing. And the thing that I just kind of continued to try and remind them was that it was my path, and they just needed to just trust that they raised me in a way that was to be the person that they knew me to be, and to like take a deep breath and that I'd figure it out.
So you go to culinary school.
Yeah.
And you wanted to be a baker. Yeah. But, I mean, that was a long, you didn't all automatically go to the milk bar.
No, I moved. I was like, okay, make cookies, right? Yeah. Okay, how does that translate into an actual roadmap? I'm competitive, so I was like, okay, make cookies actually translates to be a pastry chef. Like, what does a professional person that makes cookies do? A pastry chef. Okay, I'm going to go to school because I love education. I'm a lifetime learner. That's me as a person. I want to go to pastry school. I was a big baker at home, but I knew I needed that foundation of education. I'm going to move to the most difficult city that there is to live in. And I am going to go to the toughest culinary school. And I'm going to go to the city where the food scene is the biggest and the brightest and the most competitive. And then I'm going to just take off sprinting. And so I moved to New York. I knew no one. I had been for like 12 hours once as a teenager. I was just like, this is it. This is the plan. Head down. Go. And I went to culinary school, found an apartment, hit the pavement, got a job, and then in every moment of my free time, got as much experience as humanly possible, because when I put my mind to something, like, I'm all in. And so I worked for great chefs in fine dining institutions back then in the food scene. This is 2003. Being a pro in the food and beverage world was working at fine dining. Fine dining is still a thing now, but what I ended up becoming a part of and starting a revolution of was democratizing dining so that it wasn't this 4-star, really open up your pocketbook in a way that my mother, the accountant, would be like, "Do you do not need to go out to dinner?" And so you worked for the very, very, very best, most competitive French chef or Spanish chef or American chef, and a very big, very daunting white tablecloth. You got 4 forks on the table. Which one are you supposed to use? Like, that's what I did for a decade. I worked for other people, and I was other chefs' soldiers before I blazed my own trail and opened Milk Bar.
you must have had moments of doubt. I mean, you sound like you're very obviously passionate and you're working, you know, kind of, you know, tunnel vision towards this goal. But wasn't there ever a moment where you were like, man, did I do the right thing?
I never questioned myself. I think because I was fortunate enough to know exactly what I was passionate about, I never had to have like a real talk moment with myself. When people ask for advice, I say, I only know what my path and my journey was. And what I know is that I chose the thing that fulfilled me so much. It didn't matter if I was getting paid minimum wage. It didn't matter if I was getting treated like garbage. It didn't matter if my clothes didn't fit at all. It didn't matter. I loved doing it when no one was looking. And I loved doing it after everyone had gone to bed at night and long after anyone had thought about setting their alarm in the morning. Like it was the thing that just fulfilled me when no one, when nothing else mattered, it mattered to me. But what I did have to do was then rectify this, like, fine dining pastry chef versus who I am as a person. And what I did end up doing was taking a wide array of jobs across the food industry. Because as I worked my way up on this fancy fine dining pastry chef trajectory, I was like, this is great. I love the pursuit. I don't know that I really care about how perfect this beautiful tuile is. I care for the person I'm soldiering for, but that means less to me. And so I was an editorial assistant at a food magazine, and I was a food stylist, and I was a caterer. I worked on the dining room end of things for Thomas Keller and got my butt whooped in the best way possible because I was just so curious about figuring out where my place in this wild, wonderful world was and what spoke to that deep, deep, deep down. And so there wasn't a questioning, but more than anything, it was like I had like a little metal detector and I was walking around New York City waiting for it to go off. And it wasn't until I met Dave Chang at Momofuku in 2006 that I finally realized that my voice was a much, much, much more casual, accessible, democratic voice in the world of food. And that I love baking because I have a very sweet tooth, so I like to eat the cookie dough myself. But more than anything, the thing that actually really makes it worth it is feeding people and the emotion that you are giving or gifting when you give someone a cookie or you bake someone a batch of brownies or you give someone a cereal milk ice cream. That emotion, that connection was actually what it was for. And the more people I could reach and the more people I could feed, the better. And that remains true to this day.
Talk about that. I mean, how seminal Dave Chang, obviously an amazing branding person, amazing chef. He's all over the world doing things. You started working with him.
Yeah.
How did that change your life? And then also kind of talk about Milk Bar at the start of it. Kind of, you know, wasn't necessarily intuitive that next to Momofuku you would have an
American style bakery next to like this pseudo Asian concept of a restaurant.
Right.
So Dave was also in a similar path. He went into fine dining and he ended up getting out of it and opening Momofuku Noodle Bar because there was just this question of like, what's it for? If I'm going to bust my butt doing something, I want to do it and feed human beings and feed them like loud and proud with the flavors that I think are great, not with like a beautiful tornado turnip. Does that really convey the spirit of like, like love and emotion and passion that you have as a cook working that hard? I met him. We literally grew up like miles from each other in Virginia, which is crazy. Didn't know each other, but we had a very similar sensibility. We hit it off right away. I met him because in my free time, I was also like, maybe it's food science and maybe I'll learn how to write these hazard analysis plans for the health department. Just free time. Hashtag free time. And so I met
him. Get a lot of hobbies here.
I sign up for a lot of clubs. And so I met him through that. And I immediately, when I met him, I was like, this guy will do whatever it takes to see his passion and his vision through. And those are the kind of people for me that are magnetic. I saw it, I got it with very little explanation. He offered me a job in an unkitchen related capacity. He was like, help me run the business. Help me figure out what in the world is happening to my business. And I jumped. Like, my best decisions in life are not the ones that take me 5 days to figure out. They're the ones that are just like, make cookies. Yes, I'll take the job. Jump. Because somehow I have the ability to, like, 86 the fuzz in my head or whatever it is and just be like, what's the answer? Go. And I worked for him, with him for years, building his restaurant group. He knew I had dessert experience, so there was this, like, back and forth of, like, just make desserts for the restaurants. Eventually convinced me to do it, and I did it. But in this amazing, beautiful world, what he was also teaching the world and me was, like, break the rules. Like, I got it. You went to culinary school. You worked in fine dining restaurants. You know all the rules. Now it's time to break them. And not break them just to break them. Break them because they need to be broken in order for you to find your space in the world, in order for you to occupy as little or inevitably as much space as there is for you to occupy and that you deserve. And after a few years of doing that and making desserts for the Momofuku restaurants, Dave, we're like brother and sister. We're kin through and through. And he knew that, like, I could not really, I'm not like a, you can't chain me. Like, I'm going. I will work for you, but I'll have 101 hobbies. And he saw that I needed to be my own boss. Inevitably, like, immediately, he was like, I'm not your boss. Just do your thing. And he knew that I always wanted to have a bakery. And, he was just like, just do it. I'm here for you. I'll help give you the seed money. I will support you. You can use the Momofuku name as your launch pad. It's loved, it's known, it's trusted. And so November 15th, 2008, I just took the leap. No business plan, no pro forma, no P&L. Like, the only plan was, you know it, you love it, you're passionate about it. And I was fortunate enough to have someone that was like, I see you and I believe in you. I don't get the desserts necessarily. Like, why are you putting coffee and pretzels and potato chips into a cookie? I mean, I get it when I eat it, but, like, okay. Go, like, just go. Go and go now and mean it and mean it. And I think he knew that I had the same in him of, like, whatever it takes, go and do it.
So obviously you have a lot of confidence. You have the backing of a very successful restaurant behind you. But what was there a moment where you were like, all right, this is going to work. Like, we're going to grow. We're going to be bigger than maybe one bakery.
Yeah. I realized on opening day, on November 15th, 2008, I was so busy doing, like, in the middle of the night, scraping paint off the walls and resealing a column and doing all the things. Because guess what? Like, real talk, when you're opening your first place, I'd raised money for the first time last year, 9 years into the business. And I wanted to know that what I was doing was a real thing, was authentic, that it was a business, that I could be a viable business person. And so I didn't have time for self-doubt. I didn't have time to be like, what is this business and where is it going and what should it be and really digging into what a real, probably, like, more weathered business person, how they might think about it. But it was on opening day. I opened the doors. I had gotten like 30 minutes of sleep. I had puked like 3 times because I was more stressed out about getting all the layer cakes that weren't frosted on the sides in the case. And I was more like stressed out about, like, is everyone going to come to work? And do they know how to describe this? And oh my God, we forgot to write the menu on the chalkboard. Like, all of the most basic, simple things. But thank goodness, because I had no time to worry about the real big things. And I opened the doors and there was a line out the door and around the corner. And I was like, where did all these people come from? We didn't talk about it. Press, media, the digital element of it all existed very differently in 2008. Where did all these people come from? Why in the world are they waiting in line for 2 hours or 3 hours? And it was maybe an hour in when we started to sell out of things and started to make them all anew that I was like, people get it. They get what crack pie is and they're super into it. And they get this, that, like, the bottom of this bowl of cereal whipped into an ice cream, they get it. They're inspired by it. They're energized by it. And then from there, it was like, okay, then, but now what, right? Like, what do I do and now what? And that's been the most incredible think or question to have to answer in the past nine and a half years.
So one of the things I did want to ask you was about raising the money. It's something that a lot of women struggle with. It's, you know, you get a lot of rejections potentially. Talk to us about your process. I mean, it's a little different because most people are raising money not 9 years in for the first time.
Yeah. So I chose not to raise money for a really long time. And I did that because I wanted to make sure that I was building a business that for me, in my own definition, was a business of substance, was a business that could stand on its own, was a business that knew what it was without having to deal with the pressures of voices and opinions and accountabilities. And that was very important to me. It's a bakery. So who do you want to buy a cookie or a slice of pie or a cake from? You want to buy it from like a human being that is based, that has a point of view and a perspective. And I was slow and steady about that. Inevitably, for 9 years of growth, I had to, instead of raising money, I would do crazy things. Like be like, I'm going to go write a cookbook. That'll let me open two stores. I'm going to do this partnership or this deal over here or make this recipe for this group or company. I bootstrapped it. Like I figured out how to game the system without giving away equity in my business. And that was really important to me. The fact of the matter was that there was a point in time where then I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? The world is moving faster and faster than I am able to grow my business organically. And so I spent a year and a half doing all of my research and figuring out all of the different ways that I might take money to grow and leverage the business much more than we were going to just taking our own profits. And I used this like mantra and this guide of you can't do a good deal with bad people and you can't do a bad deal with good people. So that I put myself in this position of, all right, well, who is that good person that I can do a deal with? And you learn a lot about a lot of things, but I'm a lifetime learner and I love a great challenge. And I don't think it is about man versus woman. I got plenty of stuff along the way of like, you're so difficult to work with, like you're so difficult or you're so defensive or X or Y or Z. And I try and like lock myself into like an emotion-free room because it's an emotional process. It's emotional when you have your own business, but you got to be as strong and steady and sure of yourself as possible. And I'm so happy with the decision I made because it's given me now an incredible amount of leverage to further grow and legitimize my business, my role in it. And that for me is what makes it all worth it.
I wanted to ask you, obviously, the food industry, like a lot of industries, journalism has definitely had the kind of the Me Too movement moment. Did you have your own meat? I mean, you kind of talked about it. You were the only woman in the kitchen for a long time and basements wearing, you know, probably looking like a dude because you were wearing men's clothes.
Yeah. I wore an obnoxious headscarf on my head with a huge bow, like really right here on top of my head. Because I was just like, I'm here and I'm not going anywhere and I'm going to look ridiculous and I hope it makes you uncomfortable. I hope it makes you really uncomfortable because it makes me feel great. No, that's a reality. For sure, in kitchens, that's a reality. I remember being in elementary school and like getting my butt pinched when I was like in third or fourth grade. But I was also fortunate enough to be raised as like a spicy Scorpio to be like, you didn't. Like, I will smack your hand and we are going to the principal's office right now because I'm going to shame you hard. This is not for you. And I was just fortunate enough to be raised with that. Like, I go into a very aggressive place in a way that's like, I will scare you. I'm a scary person if you approach me in that way. And I think one of the silver linings of building and growing Milk Bar that I definitely could not see going into it was creating a business where we employ 200 plus people and we create an amazing safe zone where you're empowered. We have a lot of women that work for us. We have a lot of incredible men that work for us. And there are a lot of incredible men out there as well. And that for me has been something I've been so incredibly grateful for and will continue to do as much as I can to help give like the strength of the voice and like, I'm scary. Do not come near me. I am good. I want to be your best friend, but I will scare you if you step out of line.
I'm a little scared.
With a smile. You're like, okay, your intensity, let's take it down. No, but you got to be that intense. Like, don't, I, from like an energy standpoint, it's also like my best, my favorite things are like, I bring energy in and I leave feeling energized. And you gotta know what you bring and be confident in it.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about, there's a lot of celebrity chefs, Jose Andres and others, who've gotten more political. Mm. Is that something that you've ever kind of dipped your toe into, or you could see, or you think is an important part of any areas that you're, you know, very focused on?
I think when you have, for me, Milk Bar is such a close and true extension of who I am. Starting Milk Bar, it's food for the people. It's baked goods for the people. And I was raised by a family that was like, you don't talk about money at the table and you don't talk about politics at the table. And that's not because I don't have my own views that I very strongly stand behind, but it's been important to me that Milk Bar is a place of inclusion and that it's a place that you're welcome and that has a sense of community, and that we learn how to be respectful in how we respect each other as people and how we respect one another's opinions. But the things that are clear that I do stand behind from a political standpoint are just like the power of women, the power of amazing women, and being good to one another and agreeing, but respectfully agreeing with each other or disagreeing with each other. And that respect is paramount, man, woman, right, left, whatever it is, or otherwise, beyond man and woman.
We are about to get the wrap, but I want to leave this audience and our listeners with, you know, what's next? What should we be expecting? You're obviously, you know, expanding a lot.
Yeah.
You're on television, but if there's one thing in, you know, the rest of 2018 that we should be looking for from you.
Well, we're building a huge flagship in Washington, D.C. So,
very
girl,
exciting.
I got you. Classroom. We have like our own old auto body shop that we're going to transform into like our crazy, wonderful home. We're doing the same in Los Angeles. And yeah, for me, it just more of like, what is my place in the world? Did I leave it better today than I did yesterday? And that for me is like the question that I ask myself.
Thank you so much, Christina. We really appreciate your time. All right. Thanks so much, guys.
Women Rule is produced by Rena Flores. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our booker is Jessica Andrews. If you're a fan of the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. We've got a lot of great guests coming up. In coming weeks, we'll bring you conversations with actress Bellamy Young and Tamara Mellon, the founder and former creative director of the Jimmy Choo shoe line. You don't want to miss any of those episodes, so hit that subscribe button, and thanks for listening.